Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 39, part 3. A silence closely resembling stupidity. Readings from Eduardo Galeano's Open Veins of Latin America, 5 centuries of the pillage of a continent. Once again, reading from The Foreword by Isabel Allende. Open Veins of Latin America is an invitation to explore beyond the appearance of things. Great literary works like this one wake up consciousness, bring people together, interpret, explain, denounce, keep record, and provoke changes. There is one other aspect of Eduardo Galeano that fascinates me. This man who has so much knowledge and who has, by studying the clues and the signs, developed a sense of foretelling, is an optimist. At the end of Century of the Wind, the third volume of Memory of Fire, after 600 pages proving the genocide, the cruelty, the abuse and exploitation exerted upon the people of Latin America, after a patient recount of everything that has been stolen and continues to be stolen from the continent, he writes, "The Tree of Life knows that whatever happens, the warm music spinning around it will never stop. However much death may come, however much blood may flow, the music will dance men and women as long as the air breathes them and the land plows and loves them." This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Continuing with another paragraph from Isabel Allende. "This breath of hope is what moves me the most in Galeano's work. Like thousands of refugees all over the continent, I also had to leave my country after the military coup of 1973. I could not take much with me, some clothes, family pictures, a small bag with dirt from my garden, and 2 books, an old edition of the Odes by Pablo Neruda, and the book with the yellow cover, Las Venas Abiertas de America Latina. More than 20 years later, I still have that same book with me. That is why I could not miss the opportunity to write this introduction and thank Eduardo Galeano publicly for his stupendous love for freedom and for his contribution to my awareness as a writer and as a citizen of Latin America." Part three of, yes, there's going to be a part four, because there's a last section in the book, which is 7 years after, and 7 years after the book was first written. In the last 30, 40 pages or so, there's just so many things that I've been underlining and wanting to share. So I'm going to jump right in and read some more. This bit again shows the just phenomenal writing and a way to convey the experience and the information in just a wonderful way. This is the section called "Which Flag Flies Over the Machinery." The old woman stooped and fanned the fire with her hand, back bent, wrinkled neck extended. She looked like an ancient black tortoise, but her ragged dress certainly gave less protection than a shell, and, after all, it was only the years that made her so slow. Behind her, the wall of her hovel, made of bits of wood and tin, sagged like its occupant. Beyond were similar hovels of the Sao Paulo slum. Before her, the water for coffee was boiling in a blackened kettle. She lifted a small tin can to her lips, and before drinking, shook her head and shut her eyes. "Oh, Brazil é nosso," she said. "Brazil is ours." In the center of the same city and at that same moment, the executive director of Union Carbide was thinking the same thing, but in another language. As he raised a crystal glass to drink to the firm's capture of still another Brazilian plastics factory, one of the two was mistaken. And I may have read that already, I'm not sure, but it's worth reading again. He goes on to describe how a law was passed, and that same day the law was annulled, and you know what happened between the time that the law was passed and annulled. And so again, that kind of be inside, behind closed doors stuff going on. One thing that I noticed too about this piece, about the writing, is ways that writers can pick up tips. Like I'll see something here that I like and make a note to try that. The way he uses the word "and," for example, and in phrasing his sentence. "But her ragged dress certainly gave less protection than the shell, and after all, it was only the years that made her slow." There's a certain pause and cadence there. And he does it again. "She lifted a tin can to her lips and, before drinking, shook her head and shut her eyes." So there's a kind of way that the writer puts in bits of information that makes for interesting writing. There's a couple of lines that I highlighted as black humor, in the sense that the way Galeano describes it, and here's a couple of them. "Alliance credits were sown in Goulart's path like explosive mines." And then another one. There's an organization called ADELA, A-D-E-L-A. "ADELA is not a Mexican revolutionary song, but the name of an international investment consortium." And a little bit more on the inside job theme. "Like all the other one-armed bandits of international high finance, the bank is also an efficient instrument of extortion for the benefit of very specific circles. Its chairman since 1946 have been prominent U.S. businessmen. Eugene R. Black, chairman from 1949 to 62, later became a director of several private corporations, one of which, Electric Bond and Share, is the world's top monopolist of electrical energy. By chance or otherwise, in 1966, the World Bank made Guatemala accept a gentleman's agreement with Electric Bond and Share as a condition for implementing the Hurun-Marinala hydroelectric project. The agreement was to pay the firm a fat indemnity for possible damages in a river basin site which had been given it as a present some years earlier, and included a state commitment not to interfere with Electric Bond and Share in its fixing of electricity rates. By chance or otherwise, the World Bank in 1967 made Colombia pay a $36 million indemnity to the Electric Bond and Share affiliate
Compañía Colombiana de Electricidad for its old, recently nationalized machinery. The Colombian state thus bought what belonged to it, but the concession to the enterprise had run out in 1944. Three World Bank chairmen are stars in the Rockefeller power constellation. John J. McCloy, who presided from 1947 to 49, moved on into a director's chair at Chase Manhattan Bank. His successor, Black, crossed the road in the opposite direction, coming from the Chase Manhattan board. This is exactly what was described in the movie Inside Job with the 208 financial bailout and the revolving door of Wall Street and politics. His successor, Black, crossed the road in the opposite direction, coming from Chase Manhattan board. Black was succeeded in 63 by another Rockefeller man, George D. Woods. By chance or otherwise, the World Bank directly participates with one-tenth of the capital and substantial loans in the biggest Rockefeller venture in Brazil, South America's most important petrochemical complex, Petroquímica União. And a poetic refrain there, by chance or otherwise. And another bit here, the World Bank and the IMF function in close harmony and for common ends. They were born together at Bretton Woods. The United States has one-fourth of the votes in the World Bank. The 22 countries of Latin America have less than one-tenth. The World Bank responds to the United States like thunder to lightning. And more on the rigging. The so-called free play of supply and demand in the so-called international market does not exist. The reality is a dictatorship of one group over the other, always for the benefit of the developed capitalist countries. The decision-making centers where prices are fixed are in Washington, New York, London, Paris, Amsterdam, Hamburg, in cabinet meetings and on the stock exchanges. It means little or nothing that international agreements have been signed to protect the prices of wheat, 1949, sugar, 1953, tin, 1956, olive oil, 1956, and coffee, 1962. A glance at the descending curve of these products' relative value shows that the agreements have only been symbolic excuses offered by strong countries when the prices of the weak countries' products sank scandalously low. What Latin America sells gets constantly cheaper and, also in relative terms, what it buys gets constantly dearer. For the price of 22 bullocks, Uruguay could have bought a Ford Major tractor in 1954. Today, more than twice as many are needed. A group of Chilean economists who made a survey for the trade unions calculated that, if the price of Latin American exports had risen since 1928 at the same rates as the price of imports, Latin America would have received $57 billion more for its sales abroad between 1958 and 67 than it actually received. The outsourcing produces cheap stuff, but again, in this holistic picture of the globe, it is not cheap. It is the low wages that determine the low prices, says Emmanuel, not the reverse. The poor countries export their poverty, further impoverishing themselves in the process, while the rich countries get the opposite result. And the coffee rigging. But the most startling contradiction between theory and reality in the world market emerged in the open soluble coffee war in 1967. It then became clear that only the rich countries have the right to exploit for their own benefit the natural comparative advantages. But the most startling contradiction between theory and reality in the world market emerged in the open soluble coffee war in 1967. It then became clear that only the rich countries have the right to exploit for their own benefit the natural comparative advantages which theoretically determine the international division of labor. The sensationally expanding soluble coffee market is in the hands of Nestle and General Foods. Before long, it is believed these two will be supplying more than half the coffee consumed in the world. The United States and Europe buy coffee beans in Brazil and Africa, concentrate it in their industrial plants, and sell it worldwide in soluble form. Brazil, the biggest coffee producer, does not have the right to compete by exporting its own soluble coffee, thereby taking advantage of its obviously lower costs and providing an outlet for the surpluses which it once destroyed, and now stores in state warehouses. Brazil only has the right to supply the raw material to enrich foreign factories. When Brazilian factories, a mere five in a world total of 110, began offering soluble coffee on the international market, they were accused of unfair competition. The rich countries yelled to high heaven, and Brazil accepted a humiliating imposition. It placed a huge internal tax on its soluble coffee to put it out of the running in the U.S. market. And he talks about what's called the common market. Thus, the poor countries pay their rich customers to compete against them. The price of a pound of sirloin in Buenos Aires or Montevideo is multiplied by 5 when it hangs from a butcher's hook in Hamburg or Munich. The fascinating thing is how the product is divided and conquered itself. That the product, the raw materials are allowed to be export. It shows how the global corporate empire puts its hands on tentacles on, you know, controlling the processes, which control the prices, which control the countries, and et cetera, et cetera. And to think about the rigging, you know, you ever wonder why something costs what it does? You know, why is an apple 70 cents? Or in one store the other day, an organic apple I went to buy was like $2.80, and something in my head was like, that is just more than I want to pay for an apple. So I decline that. When I think of technology, it's a new field, basically, and we sort of have no idea. You know, this software package is $29.95, but we have no idea how much it really costs, do we? We kind of take on these price acceptances, and, you know, it becomes part of this, again, this illusionary economy where things have a value put upon them, and rarely do we question, rarely do we seem to question that. I think in the price of cell phone programs, they just seem exorbitant, you know, I don't know what the actual costs are, but I am suspicious. Part of that rigged system in America, when I think of, you know, car insurance and car registration fees, it's like, you know, every couple of years, it's paying to have the registration renewal. Well, what? I mean, who determines that? It's like, oh yeah, that's cool, I get my registration again. And it is, because then I can drive around. But, you know, the more I've learned about this stuff, it's like, wait a minute, where does this money go and what does it do? And is it just part of the rigged system? And more on the global corporate empire. Thus, for the corporations' greater glory, their subsidiaries dispose of the scanty foreign currency of the Latin American countries. The operating plan of satellized industry does not differ much from the traditional system of imperialist exploitation of raw materials. Antonio Garcia maintains that Colombian export of crude petroleum has, in fact, always been the physical transfer from a U.S. oil field to refining, marketing, and consumption centers in the United States and, quote, Honduran or, quote, Guatemalan banana export has been a transfer by U.S. companies from certain colonial plantations to certain U.S. marketing and consumption areas. And here the countries again are in quotes, but the Argentine, Brazilian, and Mexican factories, to mention only the most important, also occupy an economic space that has nothing to do with their geographical location. Along with many other threads, they make up an international web of corporations whose head offices transfer profits from one country to another, invoicing sales above or below the real prices according to the direction in which they want the profits to flow. The mainsprings of external trade thus remain in the hands of U.S. or European concerns, which orient the countries' trade policies according to the criteria of governments and directorates outside Latin America. Just as U.S. affiliates do not export copper to the USSR nor sell oil to Cuba, neither do they get raw materials and machinery from the cheapest and most convenient sources. And then he also refers to the global publicity campaigns and ad campaigns, which is part of this whole deal, to the point where, you know, certain products, whether it's Mercedes or BMW or whatever, they have this image as the cars and the status symbol, and they may well be, you know, better cars, but there's a lot that goes into it, a lot of billions of dollars, you know, manufacturing consent, as Noam Chomsky has accentuated for us. And here's a bit talking about the oil industry and then the soda, which I put the side note, snake oil salespeople. It's like a modern snake oil. The auto industry has drained $1 billion from Mexico in one way or another, but a United Auto Workers leader wrote after touring the new General Motors in Toluca, it was worse than archaic. Worse because it was deliberately archaic, with the obsolescence carefully built in. Mexico's plants are deliberately equipped with low production machinery. What should we say of the gratitude Latin America owes to Coca-Cola and Pepsi, which collect astronomical industrial licensing fees from their concessionaries for providing them with a paste that dissolves in water and is mixed with sugar and carbonation? And here's another thing touching on the what was touched on in Nick Turse's book about the prison, the complex, the military-industrial complex, and the poverty and the slums being a kind of perhaps modern-day urban warfare zone. The surplus people get an occasional nibble at a job or perform sordid or illegal tasks. They become servants, sell lemonade or what have you, get pick and shovel or bricklaying or electrical or sanitary or wall painting, odd jobs, beg, steal, mind, park cars, available hands for whatever turns up. Since the human surplus grows faster than the integrated element, the United Nations survey foresees that within a few years, the makeshift camps will house the majority of the urban population. The defeated will be the majority. Meanwhile, the system prefers to hide the dirt under the rug. It is clearing the favelas from the Bay Area and the Villa Miserias from the national capital at gunpoint, sweeping the human surplus out of sight by the thousands upon thousands. Rio de Janeiro and Buenos Aires conjure away the spectacle of the poverty the system produces. Soon only the mastications of prosperity, but not its excrement, will be seen in these cities where the wealth created by all of Brazil and Argentina is squandered. I think that's going on with the World Cup. It's happened before where they build new stadiums and sweep out the homeless because it'll be on NBC. And there are no homeless people on NBC. Here's an example of the ongoing ongoing colonialism and touching into the U.S., similar to the United States Empire. The growing relative backwardness of the great hinterlands submerged in poverty is not, as some maintain, due to their isolation, but on the contrary to direct or indirect exploitation by the old colonial centers now converted into industrial centers. According to an Argentine trade union leader, a century and a half of our history has witnessed the violation of all the solidarity agreements, the breaking of the faith sworn in hymns and constitutions, the domination of the provinces by Buenos Aires, armies and customs, houses, laws made by few and endured by many, governments that with some exceptions have been agents of foreign powers, built this proud metropolis that accumulates wealth and power. But if we seek the explanation of that grandeur and the penalty of that pride, we will find it in the missionaries' yerba mate plantations in the dead communities of the Forestal Land Timber and Railways Company, in the despair of Tucumán sugar mills and Jujuy mines, in the abandoned ports of the Paraná, in the exodus from Berisso. A whole map of misery surrounding a center of opulence secured by the exercise of an internal domination which can no longer be dissimulated or accepted. And then, again, that thing about the hypocrisy and the rich and the poor. Dependent industrialization further concentrates income at the regional and social level. The wealth it generates does not spread through the whole country or the whole society, but consolidates and deepens existing inequalities. Latin America's low wage scale is reflected in the low prices the region gets for its raw materials in the international market to the benefit of consumers in the rich countries. And he sort of maps it out here. The escalation economy now prevails. The first phase carried out during these recent years has seen the consolidation of foreign power over the launching platforms, the industrialized cities, from which the regional market as a whole is to be dominated. The enterprises in Brazil with the greatest interest in Latin American integration are precisely the foreign ones and above all the most powerful ones. Again, this book originally from 1971, but it really helps to understand some of the blueprints of what's going on nowadays. And again, as from a writerly view, this bit kind of marvel at the sentence structure. I'll try to pause where some of the commas are. They forget that a legion of pirates, merchants, bankers, marines, technocrats, green berets, ambassadors, and captains of industry have, in a long black page of history, taken over the life and destiny of most of the peoples of the South, and that at this moment Latin America's industry lies at the bottom of the Imperium's digestive apparatus. Not only is it a long sentence, but quite a graphic metaphor there. And while reading this book, I realized just towards the end of it that it is really, it's sobering, and it is pulled what was left of the wool off of my eyes as far as the way things work in the corporate material world and all that. The entrenched system, it's a clue as to why the elites nowadays assume they deserve to do what they do. That this has been going on for hundreds of years, and I think that's really important as citizens, activists, artists, that we remember that when pondering and deciding tactics, that it's not always what we think might make change or convince change, but we're dealing, that phrase, know the enemy. It's dealing with systems and entrenched weight workings that have been going on for years, and the psychology behind that, it takes time to change that. So, rather than see it as a direct enemy and fight it, it's a matter of working with it in a certain way, making positive change. A recent short bit by John Trudell that I heard, he talks about you cannot fight the system. You cannot fight the system, but you can outthink them. That you can cultivate your own mind, your own energy, your own spirit, and literally make, you literally enhancing the energy rate of your mind or your aura or whatever, and that is ultimately what makes the real change. And that, when we do certain actions like voting, he said that is a tool, to see it as a tool, but it's not the real power. Okay, gonna wrap up this part with a live cold reading of the last few pages that I have not even read yet. And it's a technical note, if this section sounds a little different, I had to make some audio filtering adjustments, so that's the reason. This section is called, As Simon Bolivar Prophesied, We Shall Never Be Happy, Never. This obviously an important reference to Simon Bolivar, because that explains the revolutionary process stemming out of Venezuela and Bolivia and with Ecuador and other parts of Latin America. For U.S. imperialism to be able to integrate and rule Latin America today, it was necessary for the British Empire to help divide and rule us yesterday. An archipelago of disconnected countries came into being as a result of the frustration of our national unity. When the peoples in arms won independence, Latin America stood on the stage of history with a common bond of tradition between its diverse regions, territorially united, speaking two languages of the same origin, Spanish and Portuguese, but lacking one essential condition to form one great nation, economic community. The poles of prosperity that flourished to supply Europe's need for metals and foodstuffs were not interconnected. The ribs of the fan had their vertex across the ocean. People and capital were displaced according to the rising and falling fate of gold or sugar, silver or indigo, and only the ports and the capitals, the leeches of the productive regions, had a permanent existence. Latin America was born as a single territory in the imaginations and hopes of Simón Bolívar, José Artigas, and José de San Martín, but was broken in advance by the basic deformations of the colonial system. The oligarchies of the free trade ports consolidated this structure of fragmentation, which was their source of profit. Those sagacious traders could not incubate the national unity that was the essence of the European and U.S. bourgeoisie. Throughout the past century, the British, Spain's, and Portugal's heirs, since before independence, perfected this structure by means of diplomats' white-gloved intrigues, bankers' extortions, and the merchants' capacity for seduction. For us, the fatherland is America, Bolivar proclaimed, but Gran Colombia was divided into five countries, and the liberator died defeated. We shall never be happy, never, he said to General Urdaneta. Betrayed by Buenos Aires, San Martín stripped off the insignia of command, and Artigas, who called his soldiers Americans, went to a solitary exile's death in Paraguay. The Rio de la Plata viceroyalty had been divided into four. Francisco de Morazán, creator of the Federal Republic of Central America, died before a firing squad, and the waste of America was split into five pieces. Panama, the canal with the rank of republic invented by Teddy Roosevelt, was added later. Today, the world sees the result. Any of the multinational corporations operates with more coherence and sense of unity than the congeries of islands that is Latin America, broken up by so many frontiers and such a lack of communication. What integration can be achieved among themselves by countries that have not been able to integrate internally? Each country suffers from deep fissures in its own body, bitter social divisions, and unresolved tensions between its great marginal deserts and its urban oases. The drama is reproduced on the regional level. The railroads and highways created to transport foreign products by the shortest routes still bear irrefutable witness to Latin America's impotence or incapacity to make the national dream of its heroes come true. Brazil has no permanent land connections with three of its neighbors, Colombia, Peru, and Venezuela. Atlantic seaboard cities have no direct cable communications with Pacific cities, so that telegrams between Buenos Aires and Lima or Rio de Janeiro and Bogota have to go through New York. The same with telephone communications between the Caribbean and the South. Each Latin American country still identifies with its own port, a negation of its roots and real identity, to such an extent that almost all intra-regional trade goes by sea. Inland transport is virtually non-existent. Furthermore, the global freight cartel fixes rates and itineraries to suit itself, and Latin America merely endures the exorbitant charges and ridiculous routes. Of the 118 regular shipping lines operating in the region, only 17 fly regional flags. Freightage bleeds the Latin American economy of $2.6 billion a year. Thus, merchandise shipped from Porto Alegre to Montevideo arrives faster if it goes via Hamburg, and the same for Uruguayan wool bound for the United States. Freightage from Buenos Aires to a Mexican Gulf port is more than 25% lower if the shipment goes via Southampton. Shipment of timber from Mexico to Venezuela costs more than double the shipment of timber from Finland to Venezuela, although the maps still insist that Mexico is closer. A direct shipment of chemical products from Buenos Aires to Tampico in Mexico costs far more than if it is routed via New Orleans. What the United States set out to achieve for itself and did achieve is certainly different. 7 years after their independence, the 13 colonies had doubled their territory, already extending beyond the Alleghenies to the banks of the Mississippi, and 4 years after that they forged their unity by creating a common market. Purchase of the Louisiana Territory from France in 1803 again doubled the land area. I'll have to footnote that that was not a purchase of the Louisiana Territory, but a stealing, really. Then came Florida, and at mid-century, the invasion and amputation of half of Mexico in the name of, quote, manifest destiny. Then the purchase of Alaska and the usurpation of Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. The colonies made themselves a nation, and the nation made itself an empire, putting into practice aims clearly expressed and pursued from the remote days of the, quote, founding fathers. While the North of America grew, developing internally with its expanding frontiers, the South developed outwardly and blew into fragments like a grenade. There's that big distinction that was made in a previous show, the difference between the North and South America, even though on a cursory glance, it's, you know, abuse of the indigenous population. The workings of it are a bit different. In the present process of integration, we neither re-encounter our origins nor come nearer to our goals. Bolivar prophesied shrewdly that the United States seemed fated by Providence to plague America with woes in the name of liberty. General Motors or IBM will not step graciously into our shoes and raise the old banners of unity and emancipation which fell in battle, nor can heroes betrayed yesterday be redeemed by the traitors of today. It is a big load of rottenness that has to be sent to the bottom of the sea on the march to Latin America's reconstruction. The task lies in the hands of the dispossessed, the humiliated, the accursed. The Latin American cause is above all a social cause. The rebirth of Latin America must start with the overthrow of its masters country by country. And again, this is what makes nowadays so significant when Ecuador told the U.S. that, to get its army base out of the country. Correa said, how would you like it if we had an army base in Florida? And Venezuela nationalizing the oil industry. Again, these are examples of what has changed since this book, and why Latin America is such a significant region, and why this show is spending so much time on this topic. I'll just repeat that sentence and finish up here. The Latin American cause is above all a social cause. The rebirth of Latin America must start with the overthrow of its masters country by country. We are entering times of rebellion and change. There are those who believe that destiny rests on the knees of the gods, but the truth is that it confronts the conscience of man with a burning challenge. And that's the official end of the first of the part two of the book. Part three, again, we'll leave for another time, another show. It's 7 years after. There's an example earlier in the book where he describes a deal made between various countries, but he says it wasn't really between Argentina and Bolivia. It was in Brazil. It was between IBM and IBM and IBM. And a couple of more things here that I forgot to mention earlier is we have this sort of illusion of United States as the place to be, and for many it is. You know, many people struggling in other countries come here and do find, you know, outlets and success. But there's another side to that story, and Galeano mentions that here. On a small scale, Latin American universities turn out mathematicians, engineers, and programmers who can only find work in exile. We give ourselves the luxury of providing the United States with our best technicians and ablest scientists who are lured to emigrate by the high salaries and broad research possibilities available in the North. At the same time, whenever Latin American university or center of higher learning tries to stimulate the basic sciences to lay the foundations for a technology that is not copied from foreign patterns and interests, a timely coup d'etat destroys the experiment on the pretext that it is an incubator of subversion. The University of Brasilia, crushed in 1964, was an example of this. And the truth is that the armor-plated archangels who guard the established order are not mistaken. An autonomous cultural policy, when it is genuine, requires and promotes deep changes in all its existing structures. And one more bit towards the right before the Bolivar section. It is no accident that one-third of the processed and semi-processed products sold within the LAFTA, that's the Latin American something free trade organization or association, within the LAFTA zone come from Brazil. This is the country called upon to become the axis of all Latin America's liberation or servitude. Perhaps Senator Fulbright was not aware of the full significance of his words when, in public statements in 1965, he attributed to Brazil the mission of directing the common market of Latin America. I'm not too up on Brazil, but I think, you know, that is a very sort of modern city, and that this would explain why. So again, to catch up on what's going on, read up about what's going on in Latin America, and see the revolutions and evolutions and economic changes happening there, as in light of a history that has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. So thank you again for listening. And we'll go out with a song that's attributed to Bolivia, again from the Rebellion of the Condors CD. Cuando florezca el chuño, when the chuño is in bloom. Thank you.
que vuelves, volverás, como el río que se va al lago. Dicen que vuelves, volverás, como el río que se va al lago. Mami, Miami, cuando flores que el junio, Pawan, no Pawan, cuando flores que el junio. Vuelves, volverás, como el río que se va al lago.